This week's focus is on gender diversity. And to begin, I want you to think back to when you were 3 years old. You can remember roughly around when you were 3 years old. And just recall, what was your father's occupation and what was your mother's occupation? So where did they, if they worked outside the home, where did they go to work? If they were unemployed, that would be another characteristic. Or if they worked at home or if they worked part-time. Sort of, what was their vocational profile when you were 3 years old? And then turn to someone and share basically your parents' vocational profile. And if you didn't live with your parents, if you lived with a guardian or someone else, a grandparent, then share the vocational profile of basically your caretaker, your provider. So turn to someone and share in pairs.
So my dad was
I want to get a mapping of this classroom of your parents' vocational profile when you were three. And the reason why I say when you were three is because that's a age when you were most demanding on your parents. As far as someone, oftentimes, if you're only going to have a single family, single person working in the household, that's typically the time that it happens. And as the kids get older, both parents might then resume working full-time outside the house. But it's typically when you're three or younger. I didn't want to ask when you were one, because you probably don't remember that. But three, you might be able to remember. I want everyone to share so we can kind of get a mapping of the male caretaker in your family and the female caretaker. And if you're in a single family home, that's significant as well. So if your parents were separated or passed away or something at that age, then just say, well, it was a single parent home. So we'll just start here. And
My mom sold like commercial advertising time.
Okay.
TV station.
So sales.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
And it was a single family home or single parent family.
Okay.
My parents were both teachers.
My mom stayed at home with us, me and my sister, and my dad ran our family company.
Is it a small business or a large business?
Yeah, small business.
Might be like Google or something, or our little family, Walmart, our little family business that we...
My dad worked, my mom stayed at home.
What did your dad do?
Consulting.
My mom was a student and stayed at home, and my dad was a radio show host.
My mom stayed at home as well, and then my dad works as a manager at a factory.
My mom stayed at home and my dad was an engineer.
My mom was an x-ray tech and my dad was a doctor.
My mom was a student and my dad was an engineer.
My mom was a secretary and my dad was a cop.
My mom was an accountant and my dad was a welder.
Part of the reason for doing this is just a mapping of what are the vocational pathways available to people and what oftentimes we either follow what our parents do, or we go in the opposite direction. But a lot of times, we tended to fall into the pathway of what our parents did. And so in many ways, these vocations are gendered in some regards to where there's certain pathways that are presented to us as viable options or attractive options or appealing options because it's what our parents did. And so then when we envision ourselves and the careers that we're going to go into, we're female, we would be inclined to look towards our mother, and if we're male, we'd be inclined to look towards our father, and it replicates itself. When we talk about individual explanations versus structural explanations, this would be an example of a structural explanation for a certain outcome. So when you're 40 years old and you're in your job, and people ask you, how'd you pick this job? And you would say, oh, well, I'm good at math, and I like working behind a desk, and I like details, so that's why I'm an accountant. But I could step back and say, well, what was your father? Well, my father was an accountant, and his father was an accountant. And so there's this sort of inclination or predisposition to be an accountant because that's what you knew. Structurally, you were brought into this world in your structural position was one in a family of accountants. And so you were predisposed to be an accountant. Or likewise, if you were raised in a home where your mom was at home during the season of you being at this age, you would be predisposed to sort of look favorably upon that. Like, generally we tend to look on our childhood as a positive experience, and so we want to replicate that for our children, if you have children. And so then there's an inclination to do that. And so what that does is that shapes the job market arena and the different job and career pathways that we take. And the focus of this week is on gender diversity. And so a lot of the statistics that we read in the textbook talk about the lack of women in certain industries or certain arenas, and certainly the lack of women at higher leadership levels. And there's one individual explanation could be that simply that women just aren't as qualified. Like, they're just not as good in these industries, and they're not as good at being leaders. Or you could say there's another explanation of structural reasons or structural explanations for why there's a lack of women in certain industries and why there's a lack of women in leadership. And that's really what the focus of today is going to be on, is sort of why is there this variation? Why is there a lack of female representation in certain industries, and why is there a lack of females in leadership positions? Why is there salary differences across the board? And just begin to disentangle why that might be happening. And Arizona State University did a really neat promotional highlighting the need for diversity. And again, this is, you know, it doesn't take me much time to find examples of organizations, whether it be universities or high-tech companies or public governments, expressing the need and promoting the idea of wanting to become more and more diverse. And so here's a promotional thing that Arizona State University put together.
With more women in the U.S. workforce than ever, and with more women earning college degrees than men, it would make sense that women are getting better jobs.
And better pay.
And leading more companies. Yeah, that would make sense, but it's not happening.
We still have a major problem.
Even though the unemployment rate is less for women than it is for men, most of these jobs do not lead to senior-level positions.
The percentage of women in senior and middle leadership roles has stalled for the past decade.
The U.S. only ranks 35th in the world for women in senior management.
Most jobs for women tend to be in lower-paying industries like health, education, hospitality, and retail.
Despite more women in the workforce and better education, young women are less likely than men to aspire to top management jobs.
And most importantly, continue to make less money.
80% of a man's salary for the same job.
And minority women make even less.
And today, spouses or partners both have to work to obtain a middle-class income.
So that gives reiterates some of the statistics that you read about in the book. And one of the things that I'm interested in and somewhat fascinated by is how certain occupations or certain jobs are gendered. You get tracked into it. If you're a female, you're more inclined to, if a certain occupation is more inclined to draw and attract women, and certain occupations are more inclined to draw and attract men, and sometimes it's very prominent where it's like over 90% of the employees in a certain industry are female and likewise are male. And I want to get a sense of what some of those example areas are, where it's just like when you walk in the room or walk into an organization and you look at the composition of the employees for a specific job or a specific industry, which ones tend to be skewed towards being heavily male-dominated and which ones are more heavily female-dominated, and even which ones have switched over the years. So what are some examples that you can think of?
Like IT, I worked in an IT office this summer. GE Healthcare were mostly males.
Uh-huh, IT.
Human resources is mostly female.
Okay.
I'd say generally like secretaries are females.
Uh-huh.
If you look at like Postal Service, UPS, FedEx, it's usually men.
I'd say teachers are typically, there's more women.
At what levels?
I guess not anything but college.
So that's interesting. You know, I go to my kids' elementary school. It is very, very rare to find a male elementary school teacher. And you think about it, like if this is public schools and we're wanting to expose our kids to sort of this is their first impression of sort of the, being a part of the educational system and even learning styles. Males tend to learn in one way and females tend to learn in a different way. It's just very interesting to me, like the school is such a big part of the socialization process, and for basically kindergarten through fifth grade, I can almost guarantee that your kid will have female teachers overwhelmingly. It's a rare exception that they would have a male teacher. I'm not sure what the consequences of that are, but I do find it interesting. And then it sort of reinforces itself. If you think about yourself, the males in this room, how many of you aspire to be an elementary school teacher? If it wasn't modeled for you, if no one, when you were growing up, was either a male teacher or in your neighborhood was a male elementary school teacher, that's going to dissuade you from pursuing that career path.
Yeah, I worked in sports this summer and it was mostly male.
Like the police force and the firefighters call them mostly male.
Uh-huh.
I think nurses tend to be.
Any others that just, when you reflect on it, you think about, yeah, that is interesting. It is all.
Truck drivers
tend to be male. Are there any that have switched?
I think for a long time sales was mostly male, but it's turning a little bit more equal.
Uh-huh. One that I know of is real estate agents. So it used to be the standard that real estate agents were men, and that was, you know, a clear vocation and career path for men. But it's almost flipped to where most or the majority of real estate agents are female now. So then also what I'm interested in is within a certain organization or a certain field, where is there a clear, like, the men fit this role and the female fit this role? So like an example would be in a hospital, the doctors on average tend to be more male and the nurses on average tend to be female. Like, what can you think of other fields where there's a clear, like, there's a presence of both men and women, but there's a clear distinction, and it tends to be hierarchical, where the men are more in positions of higher power than the women, yeah.
I just say in general, like, women are going to be more like HR administration,
uh-huh.
And they're going to be more business side of things.
We'll say manager versus admin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like pilots versus flight attendants.
Okay, pilots versus... Yeah.
I would say, like, in restaurants, the cooks versus, like, the waitresses.
Okay, yeah. So, in these, you have probably gender diversity. If you just looked at the restaurant as a whole, there's a good chance it'd be 50% male, 50% female, so you'd say, it's gender diverse. But then if you look inside, you see what's very stratified, such that the men have one position that tends to be of greater, higher-paying salary, greater prestige, more power, and the women have the lesser role in that. Olivia?
I feel like in general there tends to be a lot more women that are, like, sell themselves for sex, like strippers.
Okay. Yeah, so that's a very gendered field of vocation. Yeah, I know even in my kids' elementary school, I mentioned that very few male elementary school teachers, but guess what the gender of the principal is? Male. A male principal. Again, you see that. Any ideas of why that is? Isn't that peculiar? Or can you think of an example where it's flipped? So you have a field that has both men and women, but the women tend to be in the position of power and influence and prestige, and the men are in a lower position. Yeah.
I think one thing maybe is that typically women are like, well, not typically, but like women tend to be a stay-at-home than
uh-huh.
men would be.
Uh-huh.
So men are progressing up the ladder while they're at home.
Mm-hmm. But even with that example, granted, it's the woman who becomes pregnant and has the child, and so perhaps in the first year especially, or let's say having a child realistically will take you out of the labor market at a minimum of 1 year, let's say. But it's only 1 year, because then the roles are much more interchangeable for men and women when you have a one-year-old child. Granted, it tends to be the women taking care of the child, but there's nothing to say that men can't do it or that women must do it. Do you have an explanation possibly. So I agree with you that that's a reason why women would have, they wouldn't climb the ladder as fast. But again, why is that? There's nothing inherent that would say that has to be the case.
Yeah, maybe just the fact that they're doing it later in life.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and also, many people, I mean, I'd say this next generation is dual income families. Like, that's just sort of the reality. That's the norm. If you grew up where your mom stayed at home, there's a very good likelihood that your family unit will have a dual income family unit. Or let's say your mom didn't go back to work until you were in high school. You might start going back to work when your kids are in third grade or something younger. Any other possible explanations for why there's this hierarchy and how this system sort of got set up this way? Olivia?
I'm going to say an explanation, just an industry where women are typically in power. I feel like retail.
Mm-hmm.
In general, women have more management positions.
That women have, they're in the management positions? And is it men who are on the sales floor, or is it more just a very...
It's more just like a female industry.
Okay. So it's a gendered field, so if you're a woman, you can then get into the management positions. Or even, like, I mean, the example I gave of elementary schools, I don't know the statistics on this, but I bet you a lot of elementary schools have a growing number of female principals because you tend to become a principal by being a part of the educational system and you rise up. Part of the reason why there's gender disparity is because of this system that's just sort of perpetuated and reinforced that you almost every industry, I mean, we couldn't even come up with an industry where the women are in positions of leadership and the men are in positions of lower level. And so what that affects is salary. It affects decision making. So if you think of if you're the manager or president of an organization, you're the one who decides on the policies, whether it be maternity leave or whether it be sick leave or whether it be your organization having a child care facility or all the different things that might affect employee advancement. If all those decisions in all those fields are being made predominantly by men, they're inherently going to be skewed to advantage in favor of men. And this is, I'm not sort of saying this as a guilt trip, it's just, it is a social reality. It isn't random. Like, if it was random, first of all, there wouldn't be any sort of gendered vocations. It'd be randomly selected. You would just sort of pick your vocation independent of your gender. And if it was random, the people in positions of the higher end of the hierarchy would be equally mixed between men and women, and the lower levels would be equally mixed between men and women. That would be sort of a random distribution. That would mean that there's absolute freedom. This is suggesting that there's these structures that are in place that sort of slot you into different positions, and it reinforces the idea that you'd be in these positions. And so it's not a sense of, I'll say, good or bad, or to say, you know, men have created this, and so they should feel guilty. It's more, this is a social reality, and if we're going to be managing in a context of gender disparity, and we see the value of gender diversity and gender equality, how do we manage in light of this social reality? And how do we sometimes, in a sense, push against that or challenge some of those norms or even break through some of our own biases? Like we talk about implicit bias, all these things are examples of implicit bias. So if you're thinking of hiring someone or you're a career counselor and someone says they want to be a teacher, would you sort of say, oh, well, gosh, elementary school teachers tend to be all female and high school teachers and beyond tend to be, you know, more male. And so sort of subtly shifting that person, the male student, towards being a high school teacher, sort of dissuading them or not even sort of presenting it as an option. So a lot of this is just as the manager or as a leader in society, here's the reality. If this is a little bit unsettling for you, how do you manage and lead in a way to sort of not be steered down these paths inadvertently? And a big thing that came up in the readings is this idea of salary gaps. And salary gaps are just fascinating, because if you think about it, you can think about it on a lot of times just on a national level, and you're like, okay, so women make less than men. There's probably a lot of different explanations, sort of like what Nick said. Well, maybe it's because they've chosen to have kids, and so they're out of the labor market workforce. But what I find it most interesting is when you get into a single organization, identical jobs, and there's differences, substantial differences, in what women get paid versus what men get paid. If you look at servers at a restaurant, the differences in pay or pay outcomes, or administrative positions, or even nurses, nursing industry, almost every industry, there's just differences. How that came about, I find very intriguing. You know, like, was it intentional? Did someone sort of say, oh yeah, you know, Emily, if you're going to be interviewing for this company and working for me, just to let you know, I pay women 10% less than I pay men. You okay with that? You know, I mean, that would just be ridiculous if you went into an interview and the employer said that. But essentially, that's what they're doing, that women are getting paid 10% less, sometimes 20% less, or even more. And sort of why is that happening? I'm going to show a quick clip that breaks down the differences in terms of the gender pay gap and sort of the implications of it.
You often hear about the gender pay gap, but what does that really mean? There are different types of gender pay gaps. The national gender pay gap, pay gaps within industries, and pay gaps within organizations. The national gender pay gap is the percentage difference between women's and men's average weekly full-time equivalent earnings. Over the last 20 years, the national gender pay gap has hovered between 15 and 18%. This figure can be broken down into industry categories. Every industry has a pay gap favoring men, even female-dominated industries. This gap is much more than just numbers. Behind the scenes, we find a web of interrelated work, family, and societal influences, including gender stereotypes of the work women and men should do, and the way that women and men should engage in the workforce. Women and men work in different industries and different jobs, with female-dominated industries and jobs typically attracting lower wages than male-dominated industries and jobs. This is known as industrial and occupational segregation. The lack of women in leadership also contributes to the gap, with men more likely to occupy the highest paid jobs. And there is also gender bias, both conscious and unconscious, when a person is treated unfavorably in pay and other related decisions because of their gender. But how does this all relate to an organization? Surprisingly, most organizations will have a gender pay gap. This gap can take three forms: like for like, by level, and organization wide. Like-for-like gender pay gaps occur when women and men in an organization who are doing work of equal or comparable value are not receiving the same total remuneration. By level means looking at gaps within employee categories, like managers. For a bigger picture, we look at organization-wide gender pay gaps. Underneath, we again find a web of complex, interrelated influences. Like-for-like gender pay gaps are driven by conscious or unconscious gender bias. For instance, if men receive higher starting salaries, bonuses, or pay rises unrelated to performance. This same bias can lead to part-time staff not having access to the same career opportunities, inequality in women's promotion rates, and negative outcomes when women negotiate salaries. This and a lack of flexible senior roles contribute to less women in higher levels of an organization, widening the overall organization gap. Organizations don't set out to create gender pay gaps between what women and men earn, but the gender pay gap persists. Addressing this gender pay gap ensures women and men in your company who are doing work of equal or comparable value will receive the same total remuneration.
So an interesting statistic with regard to the gender pay gap is that in order for women to make the same amount that men make, they have to work 3 months more. So if you think of your annual salary, for a woman to catch up to what their male equivalent is making, they have to work 3 more months. And that just, for me, that puts it in perspective. It's sort of like, oh, okay, what, you're making a few thousand less? Well, no, actually, in order, if you have the same budget, family budget, the number of hours you have to work extra is 1.3 times more in order just to make ends meet. To me, there's a problem with that, and some of the in industry differences I find very interesting. And there's numbers, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that just shows you briefly broken down by industry. This might be helpful if you're thinking about going into this particular industry to be aware of the disparities. So basically, if you want equal pay, go into HR, dental hygienist, or sales. Does anyone have any just sort of reactions, just gut reactions to some of this?
I mean, and doesn't this like pay gap also continue to contribute to this stereotype that women should stay home and watch the family? Because like if they have a lower paying job, then like it would make sense for them to quit their job and like the man keep his higher paying job.
Mm-hmm.
So like by continuing this continuing trend, like we're just continuing that stereotype, like, oh, well, if I hire her, then, like, in a couple of years, she's going to start a family, and then, like, I'll lose her, so, like, I'll pay her less, like, starting out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's just...
Yeah, no, so it reinforces it, it perpetuates it. And there are people who are challenging this and shaking it up, but there's so much momentum in one direction. What I find probably most interesting, and as it relates to this class, and it's similar to the exercise that we did on privilege, that... this is a social reality. This is the way it is. And so then how do you respond in light of that? You didn't choose this. This is what you found yourself in. But if you're a leader, or if you're one with privilege or with power, you have the choice to change that system, whether it be within your organization, within your field. So it's the leaders of these organizations that actually have the power to change this system. Otherwise, it's just going to continue. There's nothing that's going to cause it to be reversed. It's actual people in positions of power injecting the system and disrupting the system and doing it in ways to sort of reverse this trend. But it's the people with the power that ultimately have the capacity to do this. And so Salesforce.com, which is a high-tech HR management type company that outsources or basically serves companies around the world. The CEO of Salesforce came out with this grand initiative with regard to gender disparity, not only lack of gender diversity, but also the gender pay gap. So he is cognizant of the fact that when he looks across his organization, he sees that women are disproportionately paid less than men. And so he came up with a plan to respond to this.
There's a pay gap at cloud software company Salesforce, and CEO Mark Benioff wants it gone. Speaking to the Huffington Post, Benioff said he is reviewing the pay of each of his company's employees to ensure men and women receive equal compensation. My job is to make sure that women are treated 100% equally at Salesforce in pay, opportunity, and advancement. When I'm done, there will be no gap. The pay changes are part of a program at Salesforce called Women's Surge, which, in addition to eliminating the pay gap, is intended to balance out employment at the company. Overall, 29% of Salesforce's workforce is women. In leadership roles, that proportion shrinks to 15%. You can see some of the same skew in numbers from across the country. Numbers from the Department of Labor show the nation's full-time workforce is 41.6% women and 58.4% men. In the tech sector, where Salesforce competes, the imbalance is more pronounced. At Google, Apple, and Twitter, for example, the company-wide proportions of women in the workforce all stand at 30%.
So if you were the CEO of a company, or the president of a university, or the owner of a company, and you were aware of this gender pay gap, and you had the opportunity to rectify. Let's say you implemented a policy where you said any new raises are going to first go towards closing the gender pay gap. So you just make a company-wide policy, similar to what the CEO of Salesforce did. What I want to know is, so basically, if you were the CEO or the owner of a company, and you were, and you sort of recognize the gender pay gap, would you take that type of stand and close the gender pay gap? So if that's something that you would do, I want you to come up to the front of the room. And if you would have reservations about doing that, and there are reasons to not do it, so I'm not trying to do a straw man, because you could say, well, no, actually, if I was the CEO of a company, I would make raises based on performance, and I wouldn't look at the gender. So if that would be your perspective, then I want you to go to the back of the room. So basically, if you would recognizing this egregious situation of the gender pay gap, and you're like, this needs to stop, and I'm going to make all new raises, any new raises are going to first go towards closing the gender pay gap, come up to the front. If you would have issue with that type of policy and have a better strategy, go to the back. And this is an all or nothing. You're either all in or not. So would anyone allocate new raises towards closing the gender pay gap?
Same. I mean, I think you should go back and analyze, like, what they started out as and make sure they, like, close the gap between, like, two people that came on at the same time, one man, one woman, and one, the guy got, like, 10,000 more, like, a year.
Mm-hmm.
Like, give her an initial 10,000 to close the initial pay gap, and then whatever promotions that they got, like, you know, if that individual earned that pay raise and they earned it, but, like, the initial salary should have been equal.
Okay. And what
yeah. Pretty much the same as her.
So the initial making sure that everyone's initial salaries.
Yeah, starts off at the same level, and then like based on like their performance, just go from there.
Okay. And is the rest of you? What? Give me some. I'm gonna take this information to the CEO of Salesforce, and let him know that his approach might be flawed based on research at Indiana University. What are reasons that you would just disagree with that type of approach? Yeah.
I think a lot of men have trouble taking like a backseat to women or having women make more money than them, just instinctively, just as a man. And so I think if there's a company-wide policy to specifically target raises to women, that could rub a lot of men the wrong way
mm-hmm.
and create some friction.
Create dissension within the organization, ill feelings, yeah? Would it go both ways, Nick, if there was sort of a implicit company policy that men were just biased towards being paid more for no real performance-related reason?
I think it would, but to a lesser extent. I think men's like macho bravado, a lot of our identity is based on our job, what we make at our job,
mm-hmm.
being the provider.
Yeah.
Whereas I think women, a lot of their identity comes from their family.
Uh-huh.
Things, so it's not as important to them.
Yeah.
So I think it would happen for stronger women, but
mm-hmm.
I think it would still not be as much as.
And so, in a sense, is the gender? So the gender pay gap is not a performance pay gap. It's not a performance pay gap, unless you think it is. Unless you think that across the board, across all companies, across the nation, men are just better at all jobs in basically all industries, then it's not just a performance difference. Unless you would think, yeah, actually, men are better, hands down, across the board, in all industries. On average, men are better. So it's not I would argue, it's not a performance. I mean, performance is part of income variation, but just like in this classroom, It isn't that all the men did on average better than all the women. Like, then that would be gender difference in performance. But if it isn't gender difference, performance would be randomly distributed amongst men and women, such that the average performance of men and the average performance of women would more or less be equal. So then the question is if it isn't fully explained by performance differences, if there are gender biases, Is that something that should be addressed? Give me someone else sort of share why you would be opposed or why you would have reservations with a policy that's sort of seeking to close the gender pay gap.
Yeah, if I was starting a new company organization, I would start by making it completely equal, but if I'm in a situation with like this where it's already at a disadvantage one way or another, I think you'd have to do it like extremely carefully so the men don't like get turned off and go away somewhere to some other organization who's not going to close the pay gap because they feel they're getting treated unequally. So I think it would just have to be done like slowly and very carefully, kind of without turning too many heads.
Uh-huh.
And this seems kind of drastic.
Yeah. Well, in a sense, that's how the gender pay gap was created, slowly, subtly, just sort of over time. And especially if you have different starting salaries and you say, okay, well, everyone gets a 10% increase, you know, the person with the higher starting salary, it's exponential, multiplicative, in terms of how much more they're going to be making after 10 years compared to the person with a lower salary. So if you were starting your own business and you're hiring people, and let's say your starting salary that was listed was $60,000 a year, and you have two candidates, you're going to actually hire both of them. One's a male, one's a female. And they're both, on paper, equivalent. You're excited about hiring both of them. And the male candidate comes in and says, you offer them the job, and they say, I love this job, but I think I'm worth $65,000 a year. And you do the math, and you're like, because you'd already sort of accounted for, I'm going to offer 60, but I'd be willing to go up to 70. And so you say, okay, you know, that sounds reasonable. And then the woman candidate comes in, you give her the offer, you say $60,000 a year, she's super excited, she signs the, you know, she's ready to sign the paper. Would you say, whoa. I have a policy that I want people to start with the same pay. So I know I offered you 60, but Bob here, I upped the ante, I gave him 65. Would you do that? Would you say, I'm going to get, you know, so I see your spirit of, start everyone equal, but it's a relational dynamic. And so would you, in your sort of story, would you offer the extra 5,000?
It wouldn't make sense now.
Well, I don't know.
But
if you're sort of committed, like, I want everyone to be at equal pay.
It wouldn't make financial sense.
It wouldn't make financial sense.
Like, as a good person.
Well, no. And so a lot of these questions aren't necessarily financial questions. A lot of the things that I might be advocating or promoting in this class don't help your bottom line. Or at least on the front end, they're not going to help your bottom line. And so that's not necessarily the sole reason of going into a business, possibly. Because you could say, I want to maximize my profit. My profit. You know, the other people, they work for me. And if I wasn't here, they wouldn't have a job. And so I'm the one who should benefit from this. So even if someone wants to start a company and says, I want to make sure everyone has the same pay, starting pay, and then I'll do performance from there on. Well, performance happens, in a sense, when you accept the job. If you're a good negotiator, or if you sort of have this confidence of saying, I'm worth more. And again, we talked about this, how women are stigmatized often if they sort of pressed for more money. Like for a man to ask for a higher wage, it sort of fits the cultural profile of what a male should do. But if a woman does it, it can be perceived in a negative light. And so sometimes they're coached to be more passive in the negotiating process. So we can go back to our seats. But it was clearly a bold move by Salesforce, the CEO of Salesforce, to do this. And Salesforce is huge. I mean, this is a major company where the CEO recognizes the inequality in pay amongst the women in his company. And it sent a strong signal. Now, if you're a hotshot female in this industry and you're looking at where you want to go get a job, do you think Salesforce is going to be attracting a higher percentage of the top talent because of this decision? I think there is going to be back-end benefits to Salesforce, even though, you know, initially they'll take a hit, or maybe some of the male employees would be disgruntled. I might argue that I wouldn't necessarily want that type of employee. If they said, you know, if, again, if in a sense performance or level of position is the same. And when you think about performance, I mean, it's hard to measure that. And it's hard to, I mean, there are some metrics, but there's a lot of other qualitative things that go into the bonuses and the raises that people acquire. And so we have the gender pay gap. But another thing that's discussed is the salary disparity. We talked about diversity disparity. And what that is sort of the difference between, one example of salary disparity is the difference between what the CEO of a company makes and what the sort of the average on-the-ground worker makes. And the pay gap or the salary disparity has been growing exponentially over the years. And this is really, again, if men tend to be in the highest level positions and women in lower level positions, this relates to gender disparity and gender pay gap, but it's also an issue, a bigger issue related to income inequality and wealth inequality in the U.S. A news article that highlighted this just sort of talks about how this is a new phenomena. It isn't something that's always been, but it's a relatively new phenomena where the gap and the disparity is growing more and more.
The data that we crunch shows that the average gap in pay between a rank and file worker in an S&P 500 company and an S&P 500 CEO is 204 times. In other words, the CEO is making 204 times what the average worker is making. That's up 20% since 2009, and the gap has been widening over the decades. If you look at academic and trade union research, going back to the 1950s, the ratio was 20 to 1. By 1980, it was 42 to 1. And then you saw skyrocketing to 120 to 1 by 2000. Now, again, that 204 to 1 figure.
So you have this situation, the CEOs are making more money than they really know what to do with. I mean, at a certain point, you know, I could ask you, how much money would you need to live comfortably? And you would give me a figure, and then if I said, okay, I'm going to double that, I'm going to triple that, at a certain point, it just sort of, I would argue, becomes absurd. And yet, it sort of gets perpetuated and reinforced. And again, we go back, if this in any way is unsettling to you, or where you're just kind of like, yeah, there's just something not right about this, it's you who has the power to change that dynamic. Again, you're leaders, you're going to be leading organizations, you're going to be a decision maker, and if these patterns are going to change, it's going to be because of you. I mean, it's just like the person at Salesforce. It's the CEO who has the power and the capacity to actually change this. And so there's a company in Seattle, Washington called Gravity, and they made headlines earlier this year of a policy that the CEO did to change, to basically say, okay, I want to make it so that the lowest level employee makes a minimum of $70,000 a year. And this is the first of its kind where, you know, it's a 100-plus employee company where they made this widespread change. And it's very interesting. People are watching because this happened in April. This happened in April of this year. And everyone in all the different industries are kind of like, a lot of people are criticizing him, saying he's crazy, doesn't make financial sense, it's bad organizational planning, it's going to hurt morale. But we don't know what the outcome is going to be. And I, personally, like the courage and the boldness of this type of decision that he made.
Big companies like McDonald's and Walmart have raised their minimum wages, but it's nothing like what Dan Price is doing at Gravity Payments. The 30-year-old CEO says he wants to confront income inequality in America. So he slashed his own paycheck and raised the minimum salary at his company to $70,000. CEO Dan Price made the announcement at his company's quarterly meeting.
And we're going to have a minimum $70,000 pay rate for everyone that works here.
The minimum salary at the credit card processing company will immediately jump to at least $50,000 and rise to $70,000 within 3 years. The reaction of his 120 employees went from subdued shock to a standing ovation.
I do pay for daycare out of pocket.
Alyssa O'Neill is a 21-year-old single mother who works in customer service. Overnight, her annual salary jumped from $37,000 to $50,000.
It just gives you a little bit more confidence in your ability to just go about your day and not have to worry about going paycheck to paycheck.
Maybe I cried when I called my mom.
29-year-old supervisor Jose Garcia has $54,000 in student debt. Now those loans will be easier to pay off.
I think it's life-changing for everybody in various ways.
It's potentially life-changing for Price as well.
So I'm reducing my salary from $1 million a year to about $70,000. It's not about pay, it's about an opportunity and developing people and giving them a chance to, like, thrive and show what they can do.
Dan Price admits the salary increases will cut his company's profits in half in the near term, but having happier, more productive employees, he believes, will pay off in the long term.
You know, I want to be a part of the solution to inequality in this country. And so if corporate America also wants to be a part of that solution, that would make me really happy.
So you see here, it's not necessarily a wise business strategy, but it's very courageous, it's very bold, it's very provocative. And I'm going to give you guys an opportunity to where you are, you're the owner of a company, and you have a profit, an extra margin of $42,000. And I'm going to simplify this, because you basically have three employees. You have a president who's sort of running the organization, then you have a manager, and then you have a worker. The current salary is $300,000 a year for the president, $80,000 a year for the manager, and $40,000 a year for the worker. And so now you have $42,000. It's sort of like an end-of-year bonus. You could actually just choose to keep it all yourself. So I guess that would be a option. But I'm going to look at three different options and allow you guys to decide what you would do. So option one would be sort of proportional, where you give everyone 10% increase, you know, 10% of their salary as a bonus. So president would get 30,000, manager would get 8,000, and the worker would get 4,000. Or you could do option two, where you just divide it equally amongst the employees. Everyone gets 14,000. Or if you want to do something like Dan Price, you do option three, which is redistributed, where the president is already making $300,000 a year, so his bonus is $2,000, and then the manager and worker both get $20,000. So again, you're the owner of this company, you have $42,000, and I want you to decide which of the three options. So basically, option one will be back there, option two will be up in this area, and option three will be up here. And go to your respective places. Mm-hmm. This is three. So is anyone option one, just so I know? Okay, can you guys explain sort of just you're the owner, you're sort of running the company, and what you would decide?
Basically just like matter of responsibility and like seeing how they've started it.
Uh-huh.
I feel like it's their rewards, their money.
Uh-huh. So they're sort of carrying the most responsibility for the, so in proportion to the responsibility that they carry, they should be compensated.
Yeah.
Okay. The option two people.
Yeah, I just feel equal would be would probably go over better with managers and workers who are the people who are on, you know, the ground floor, the ones that are actually bringing in the money and stuff like that, who are physically bringing in the money. And then your president, I'm assuming he's going to be a confidant of yours if he's your president.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you could explain the situation to him a little bit, get him to understand more that you're looking to increase morale,
mm-hmm.
manager, workforce.
and then up here. Why would you do this?
I mean, the president's already making like enough money. I mean, even if you got like 0,000, you'd be making double the manager, even with like the bonus. So I just feel like, what he said, just making sure that the manager and workers know like they're appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
Since they like do like the groundwork, you should be paid like just a bonus for it.
Did you want to say anything?
So I just think it'll have a lot more impact for the manager and the worker because they're making so much less. Additionally, I think a leader looks out for the people below them, and the president should totally be cool with taking a smaller bonus to make sure people below him like do better. So that's my 2 cents.
Okay, you guys can go back to your seats. So to make this, you know, I think a challenge for me is a lot of these are hypothetical situations, and so it's hard to kind of know what you would actually do in those situations, or even if, you know, in this situation you were all the owners. What if you were the worker, and the owner called in a meeting and said, "Hey, what should we do?" And it was a collective decision, just like the woman at Gravity who says, "Well, yeah, my kid's in childcare, and that takes about 10,000 of a year of my salary, which is 25% of my salary." Whereas the president might have their kid in child care, but 10,000 is a mere fraction of what their total salary is. So in terms of our exam scores, we're going to transition to real world, no longer hypothetical. This is the distribution of grades. So it's out of 150 points. So you can see 3 people got less than 95, 4 people got in between 135 and 150, and then there's a distribution. And these are your grades. These are the number of points you have. But I want to give you, as a class, an option to boost your grades as a class. But it has to be a collective decision. And I'm going to give you three options. One is to give everyone a 10% increase in points, sort of like the salary. Everyone gets proportional to how they performed. And so you can sort of see how your distribution would change. So, and even some people would get over 150 points. Next option is just give everyone 10 points. Regardless of how you did, you can just add 10 points to your grade. And the third option is give everyone 20 points, but with a cap at 150. So if you let's say you scored 140, your score would just go up to 150. So we're not trying to make these uber wealthy, uber smart students. We want to put a cap at it. Sort of like the owner of the organization saying, you know, the president's already making 300, and as Samantha said, they're doing fine. They don't need more. In a sense, you have 150 points, you're doing fine. Olivia?
I'm confused with the differences between the first two options.
Yeah. Yeah, so the main difference is, like, if you got 150 on the exam, you get 10% more points, so you get 15 more points. But if you only scored 100, you would only get 10 more points. So it would be basically rewarding the highest performers and saying, you performed so well, we're going to even allow you to get an extra bonus. But it has to be unanimous. And if you can't come up with a decision, we'll just keep the distribution as the original. Yes.
Do we have to do this without knowing our own scores?
So that's a good question. Would you like to know your score? Yeah.
I think we can agree on this.
Yeah.
I think option 3, guys.
Does anyone disagree with 3?
No one got 150, so.
Well, did anyone get 100? Oh, yeah, you're right. Nobody did get 150, so it's going to benefit everyone. Yeah, 100% is good enough for me. Like,
oh, 3. Okay, so is anyone opposed to option 3? Okay. So, I'm going to give you your score back. Let me think about this, because I was going to give you your score so you could debate it. No, you guys acted in unison. That's good. So I will honor that. Well done. Very good. So I am going to give you your midterms back. And you guys, you surprised me, because when we did the previous exercise of Dan Price, where you're the owner of the company, I think only four of you were egalitarian, in the sense of like, you know, let's help, yes?
Do the people that aren't here get the 20?
We will give them the 20. Yes.
The difference is, though, they knew they were the owner. I didn't know I was the owner of this situation.
But you know, relatively speaking, how well you did on the exam.
Yeah, but that's relative.
I know. No, it's interesting. So, Let me. I'm going to go through sort of the exam really quickly, and then hand them back to you, so then you can have them. But a couple of things I just wanted to highlight was, so the difference between individuality and diversity. Diversity is not an attitude like tolerance; it's a description. And so individuality is sort of the unique characteristics that each of you have. Diversity is group level differences. So it's not looking at individuals, it's looking at groups. So racial groups, gender groups, class groups, whereas uniqueness is looking at individuals. Representative organization, it's not representative white men, like representative of white men, it's representative of their clientele, of their surrounding community. An organization can be diverse, but not representative of their surrounding community. Biodiversity relates to the ecosystem, the natural world, animals and species. It doesn't relate to human social diversity, but it tells us things about social diversity. So like monocultures in the ecosystem are bad. They lead to disease. So biodiversity is about the ecosystem, and it teaches us, there's sort of principles that you can learn from that that help us understand sort of the benefits of social diversity, creating a healthy environment. Mothly, I think most of you got that, so that's good. Social construction, it's basically something that doesn't inherently exist. So race, there isn't a black gene that sort of says, okay, this is black people are derived from this gene. It's something that's socially constructed. Race is something that's socially constructed, and it can change over time, and it can vary by culture. Some things that don't change over time or don't vary by culture are sort of inherent, but things that are socially constructed depend on the context that they're in. Three types of diversity. Separation diversity is on a continuum, a horizontal continuum, and so a good example is if you have age diversity. You have some people who are very old and some people who are very young all in the same organization, so you have separation diversity. Variety diversity isn't on a continuum, but it's more like a scatter plot. So you can think of religion. The more differences you have, the greater variety you have is variety diversity. And disparity diversity is a vertical continuum where you have lower class people or less educated people mixed in with higher educated people. And so you have diversity along a vertical continuum. Implicit bias. Basically, it's sort of the internal, almost unconscious ways we make decisions about people based on stereotypes. And standpoint theory was the idea that the way you see the world is based on your standpoint, your social position, and that point of view affects how you interpret or explain the situation. And so if your organization is filled with people that all occupy the same social position, you have overlap in standpoints, whereas if you can create variety of standpoints, you can look at a situation from multiple different perspectives. Any questions about the midterm? So what I'll do, basically, you'll have your score on here. I'm going to give everyone a 20-point bonus to a cap of 150 points.